A good Monday to you. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. We've been taking a closer look at the Department of Hawaiian Homelands this month. Last week, we sat down with William Ila, the acting director of DHHL, to talk about new rules to create more housing for beneficiaries. Today, we talk about complaints surrounding the foreclosure system with HPR's Ku'uwehi Hiraishi. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. That's right. So numbers, in the last 5 years, a little over 30 families have been foreclosed on or asked to be evicted from their homes on account of being delinquent on their mortgage. Now, it's not a high number when you look at about 4,500 homesteaders who are good on their loans, are good on their mortgages. But for Anahola Homesteader and Chair of the Sovereign Council for Hawaiian Homestead Associations, Robin Danner, this is preventable. In sort of looking at why these families are defaulting, why are they behind on their payments, she noticed that there were, I guess, this group of sort of looking at it from a bad habits point of view, you know, taking that trip to Vegas.
Yes.
And you can't afford it, and then you default on your loan versus bad events, so health scares, which keep you prevent you from going to work and making good on your mortgage payments. And she says for bad habits, counseling works, which is sort of the approach that the Department of Hawaiian Homelands does take. But in terms of bad events, these individuals cannot catch up. After a certain amount of time, there needs to be other options affordable to them. So she is sort of pushing for, and the Sovereign Council for Hawaiian Homestead Associations is pushing for what she calls mitigation, so loan mitigation or loss mitigation for the mortgages. Here's Danner.
You can't counsel your way out of that. What you need is mitigation, loan modifications, loan assumptions. There are strategies that re-engage the loan terms to match the current financial reality of a family. That's what's missing for our Hawaiian families. They're not getting the same access and the same level of service that non-Hawaiians get or off-homesteads get to the options of mitigation.
So we should say for the Department of Hawaiian Homelands, there is a pretty extensive process preventing foreclosure. There's a contested case hearing process where they get to go before the Hawaiian Homes Commission and sort of plead their case and tell them their specific situation. And then a payment plan can sometimes come out of that. And financial counseling is available. One-on-one on the sort of tab of the department. But even with those options in cases where there are bad events, so this one particular homesteader who was at this roundtable that Robin's group had put together, he had a spinal cord injury, which kept him out of work. He has two young kids, so his wife and mother of the kids had been taking care of the kids and not working, and he was the main breadwinner. So when he was out of work and a spinal cord injury, he could not walk, he can barely get around. He didn't have any means to sort of catch up, right? He had no extra savings to put towards this loan, and it continued to, become a delinquent to the point where eviction was a real, or for foreclosure was a real possibility. And he was saying if he had the option, kind of similar to maybe a military forbearance where there's a suspension on your mortgage payments, right? At least until you can figure out what you can do next. Or if it's a loan modification where you take that delinquent balance and put it towards the end of the loan, these sort of options were things that he said could have really helped him if that was the case. Now, this roundtable discussion that was being hosted was being done at the Lieutenant Governor Josh Green's office. And so spoke to Lieutenant Governor about what he thought about these specific situations in cases where there are bad events and what we should do about it.
Not everyone has the same story, obviously, but when you hear someone who's had that kind of hardship, then we step up for them. That's what we do. Because if we don't, they end up homeless. If they end up homeless, their family's devastated, and society pays for it in terms of higher cost, addiction, mental illness, PTSD, all those things that we constantly hear about. In this case, we can prevent it.
That's right. Homelessness has been an issue that the Lieutenant Governor has been working on, so it was a fitting conversation to be had. But a voice missing in this roundtable was the Department of Hawaiian Homelands, and according to the organizers of the roundtable, they were kept out of this discussion so that there could be more sort of free speaking on problems and also solutions. But in speaking with Cedric Dwart, spokesman at DHHL, about this issue, he brought up the idea of the wait list and the fact that some of, you know, their energy at the department is focused also on the 28,000 folks on the wait list.
We have over 28,000 people who are waiting to receive a homestead offer from the department, but we do have a responsibility to the existing lessees to try our best to keep those families in their homes. But the lessees do have a responsibility themselves to maintain that obligation. And, you know, it's really a partnership. We try to work with them. We hope that they'll work with us. And at the same time, we're working on developing lots to address the waiting lists.
And that's really the question that I posed to Danner, is if you have this wait list of folks and then you have a few at this point, I believe there are a little over 250 homesteaders who are 30 days or more delinquent on their mortgages. This is out of that sort of pool of 4,500, right? But if you have folks who have tried again and again who may not, home ownership may not be the thing that they can do right now, perhaps figuring out another option for them so that the homesteaders that are those on the wait list that are available or can afford a mortgage right now can take that spot. Why, you know, how fair is it that we're working so hard on those who may be, not be able to meet that financial obligation? This is what Donner had to say.
It's not only fair, it's right. What waitlister is hoping for the failure of another Hawaiian to be able to occupy a home? That's a false choice. Prince Kuhio gave us 203,000 acres. That acreage could double with proper management by the state. There should not be a choice which this family or that family.
That's right. So it doesn't need, according to Danner, she says, it doesn't necessarily need a legislative fix. But, you know, the department could change its procedures tomorrow to maybe outsource these cases, is something that she was pushing for. But the group will be introducing a technical amendment next legislative session to sort of insert language into the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act that includes these best practices on mitigation.
So DHHL doesn't really have anything that allows for them to kind of manipulate the...
There are options for forbearance, sort of standard fixed term forbearance. But I guess what the group wants is more options in terms of keeping these homesteaders on the land.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see how that all works then. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
That was Kuvehi Hiraishi talking about DHHL's delinquencies and foreclosures. For more on these DHHL stories, head to our website at hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're visiting one of the largest pagodas in the world. It's an example of traditional Japanese architecture and can be found in the Kyoto Gardens of Honolulu Memorial Park. The park was originally established as a community service cemetery in 1958. In 1964, the Buddhist Federation requested a monument be erected to venerate the followers of the faith. Completed in 1966, this structure is architecturally significant for three reasons. The design is based on the original proportions of the Nara Pagoda. It uses the bracketing construction techniques found in traditional design, and it's one of the largest ever built. For today's quiz, can you tell us the formal name of this pagoda? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from PBS Hawaii, presenting live What's It Going to Take?, an executive forum on making life better in Hawaii, 8 p.m. this Thursday, pbshawaii.org.
Researchers just may have found the graves of a dozen Filipino sugar workers who died in a bitter labor strike in the early 1900s. A weekend search using ground-penetrating radar detected disturbances in a graveyard on Kauai. Last week, we talked with Stephanie Castillo, a local filmmaker who just returned home to Kauai with a plan to retire. But her retirement didn't last long as she was grabbed by a story she read about, an event in our labor history. She began to dig around in her backyard to take a closer look at what led to the massacre of 16 Filipino sugar workers in Hanapepe.
It was so odd. I had come home after finishing a film project in New York City on a jazz artist. I'd worked on it for about 6 years, left Hawaii, lived in New York, and finished the film, got the distribution started, and decided to come home, and I thought I was retiring. I really didn't know what I was going to do next. I had started to write a book proposal about my 30 years as a filmmaker, and I was hoping to, you know, get into that. And I pick up the newspaper about 2 months after I got back to Kauai. I pick up the Garden Island newspaper, and there's this story about this research team looking into where the massacred workers, the Filipino sugarcane workers who were massacred in 1924, along with four police deputies, where they were buried, because they could find the deputies, but it was the workers. There were 16 Filipino sugarcane workers, and there were theories about where they were buried, but they were trying to locate the grave because in 2024, this is going to be the anniversary of the massacre, and they want to be able to put a historical plaque in place. So they need to know where is this mass grave. Some have said it's, you know, a line of coffins next to the Hanapepe Veterans Cemetery on the Filipino cemetery side. Some have said it's just a big pit. Some have said, no, the bones were removed and they put graves over it. So I read the story with a lot of interest, and it started to, you know, grab me, as good stories do. The story had stood for 95 years as a narrative, and there had been people writing papers, writing books and things about it in that 95 years. But I just felt like the story needed to be told again, because it was a forgotten story. And it needed to be updated because there were ways to look at it that hadn't been looked at it before. Mostly the record was by the sugar planters and by the police and the newspapers, and Star Bulletin and the Garden Island. Those were the standing records of what happened. There were really very few community voices that told their story, although community became very hush-hush. After the massacres, a lot of Filipinos left Hawaii, went to California. A lot of went back to the Philippines. There was just great fear among the Filipinos. So the aftermath of the massacre really is part of the story that I feel needs to be told from the perspective of the community and how it affected them. So all this is going through my head. I'm reading this article, and I can just, like, the questions start popping up. So I wasn't thinking of making a documentary. I just said, I want to help these guys. They're going to present a paper in Waikiki in July to the Filipino-American National Historical Society and their biennial conference. And I called them up and I said, you know, I'd love to help you. Can I do like a little 5-minute video to, prepare the listeners to hear the paper that you're going to present? And that's where it started. And then it grew into, now let's do a full-on documentary. And then, everything coalesced, and we've been working very fast to get this off the ground. I was already involved in the shooting because the research had already scheduled things, and I just said, let's get a crew in to follow them because they're going to look for the gravesite. We need to be with them when they look for the gravesite. They're going to bring in ground-penetrating X-ray. We need to be with them when they do that. That's all part of the story. So I hired a crew from Honolulu to come over, and, we did one shoot. We're going to do two more. We'll start interviewing also.
This also happens to be, I think, Filipino Heritage Month.
Yes.
So it's probably timely to, throw the spotlight on a story and to bring that community perspective in.
Right. Well, in 5 years, it's going to be the 100th anniversary. So this is going to make big news because it's the 100th anniversary of a massacre. I'm learning there were other massacres right around that time. Texas, Mexico, Texans involving Mexicans, blacks involved in a massacre. So right around that time, there are these massacres happening of labor workers. And so that's a whole other side I want to look at. What was going on that massacres sort of became the order of the day, if you know what I mean, after World War I? Had we so trained our soldiers that they just, automatically get their guns, their rifles get deputized? I mean, it's kind of a silly question, but I ask it because it makes me think of, when the American provisional government in the late 1900s sent the troops into Kalalau Valley to go look for one man with leprosy and his family. And these were all provisional soldiers who had fought in the Civil War, and they were like, primed to go on a hunt. And so I want to look at that question, what prompted these massacres, if it's possible to answer these questions. And there's a lot of questions I'm going to be asking in the film that may not have answers, but people have theorized, people have created mythologies, people have ideas, and there are some documentation that we can say definitely, they were buried in coffins, even though people say no, they weren't buried in coffins, they were just dumped in a grave, mass grave.
Well, so, I think there's that whole perspective of then union history, labor history in Hawaii,
yes,
and how,
yes,
that may have shaped, the landscape.
Yes, definitely, because at that time, Hawaii was ruled by the plantations and the plantation owners. In essence, they ran, or they owned the police, quote-unquote owned the police departments. They quote-unquote owned the newspapers, or the newspapers were in their hands. They had great influence in Hawaii at that time. And so my premise is that they shaped this narrative to begin with, the newspapers, the police, and the sugar plantation workers. And that narrative has stood for 95 years. Only in 1979 was there published oral histories from the community people that were either involved or children, were told the stories. So that's the first time that I know of that anybody spoke about the massacre that happened to be in the vicinity or was in part of a family. And those oral histories are at the in the Ethnic Studies Oral History Project Department. And then, there was really not much work on it. I'm trying to uncover the story more until the 90s when there was a book written, a UH Press book by John Reinecke, wrote about this strike. And then there were papers presented for the Filipino Centennial by Lindy Aquino. She presented a paper, and she definitely makes the tie-in with labor and the power of the plantations. So research exists. I'm just trying to make sure we cover all the questions, whether they can be answered or not, raise them, raise the doubts, see the holes. These are community researchers, but they're educated people. One's was a head librarian for Kauai Community College. And so I think, you know, they're very sincere in the history that they're doing. And we have a humanities scholar who's going to be guarding our research and making sure we're doing it, you know, properly, both me as a filmmaker and them as researchers.
That was Stephanie Castillo, filmmaker, who is launching a documentary on the Hanapepe massacre of 16 Filipino sugar workers as we approach the 100th anniversary of the event. Yesterday's discovery has excited the research team. There are no plans to disrupt the gravesite. Their research and work on the film is continuing.
His stories make you laugh, cry, cringe, or all three. His groundbreaking radio show, This American Life, has led to countless driveway moments. And for the first time ever, public radio pioneer Ira Glass is coming to Oahu for one night only. Join HPR and Hawaii Theater Center for his show, Seven Things I've Learned, Saturday, December 21st. We're giving HPR members early access to the best seats now, before the general public. Get yours at hprtickets.org.
It is now time for our reality check. Honolulu Civil Beat's Yu Hyun Jung covers criminal justice. She is the latest on a weekend development in the Catherine K. Aloha case. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So she finally put her name on the dotted line, huh?
That's right. She signed it.
Just yesterday.
Yeah. I was coming back from a camping trip, and I got a text from her attorney, Gary Singh, saying that yesterday morning, Catherine Kealoha signed the plea agreement at the Federal Detention Center.
Well, that's amazing, because I know people think that you do this kind of business Monday through Friday. But so what happens now? Does a judge have to approve this or what?
Yeah, well, she'll have to sign the agreement again in open court, and that's going to happen tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. at the federal court. So she'll have to sign it in front of a judge, and the judge has to approve it, of course. And then it'll be a done deal. Then, only then it'll be a done deal.
Okay, so she will plead guilty to three felonies, is that right?
That's right. And two of the felonies would be part of the bank fraud case. That's what people are calling it. And that's the one that involves her and her husband, former police chief Louis Kealoha. And then one of the felonies would be part of the drug trafficking case. And that one involves her younger brother, Rudolph Puana. And that one, you know, she and her brother are accused of, you know, running a prescription drug trafficking ring.
Okay, so what about the other two defendants? What about Chief Kealoha and what about Rudy Puana?
So we don't know anything about whether Rudy Puana is getting a plea agreement deal as well, but at least we know that as of last week, we heard that there is a proposed plea agreement deal for former Chief Kealoha as well. But his attorney, Rustin Barbie, said there is not a deal until it's signed. And as of right now, we don't know if Louis Kealoha signed his deal.
And so what happens to the judgment that was out there for Gerald and his mother, Florence?
Oh, Gerard and Florence Puana's civil judgment? Is that what you're talking
yes.
about? So that, as far as we know, that was still in the Intermediate Court of Appeals. And the last we heard was that a state court judge has agreed that since there was a conviction for Lewis and Catherine Kealoha that the state judge agreed that maybe that case should be remanded from the Intermediate Court of Appeals and there should be a new trial. So if that happens, there could be a new civil trial for that as well.
Oh, my goodness. So it just kind of goes on and on.
Yeah, it could go on and on and on. And, you know, there could be a new civil trial. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure, though, that the court is looking at with these with this plea deal with Catherine, that you will avoid then other trials that, you know, could potentially be not really messy. But we saw the lengths at which the court had to go to seat a jury in the first case.
This is true. So at least for Catherine Kealoha and possibly for Lewis Kealoha, if he also signs a deal, at least for the bank fraud case, there may not be a trial in January 2020, at least for that particular trial.
And then what happens as far as the divorce that the chief has filed? Any idea about that?
So, I mean, that's a totally different litigation process. So so the chief did file for divorce last week. That was October 15th. So that's going to have a totally separate legal process altogether. But he has said that Catherine should not be entitled to any spousal support.
Oh, very interesting developments just in this last week. But thanks so much for keeping on top of it.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
That was reporter Yoo Hyun Jung with today's Reality Check. To read her stories on this issue, visit civilbeat.org.
We're almost there. 99% of the world has eradicated polio, but there are still three places on Earth where outbreaks happen, and that affects the entire global community. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show. We'll talk to members of the Rotary Club about our need to band together and end polio for good. That's today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
Most people might agree overtourism is a hot-button issue across the state. What to do about it is another matter, but that's the subject of an upcoming Climathon. It's a competition to spur solutions to real problems. Nicole Chatterson is with the group Zero Waste Oahu. She sat down with us to talk about an upcoming event at the Impact Hub.
So this is our first time hosting a Climathon. The concept was started in 2015 in Europe, so with the European Institute of Innovation and Technology. And we signed up to host one in Honolulu because we thought it was such a great idea.
So explain to our listeners what this is all about.
Sure. So it's similar in concept to a hackathon, but it's not necessarily focused on high-tech solutions. So it's about 24 hours, and the idea is that people can bring something they've been thinking about, a climate solution, to the table, and they meet with other people who are interested in moving the solution forward. So they spend the time kind of shaping up the idea, and at the end of the 24 hours, they pitch the idea to a panel of judges. And the winning idea gets a chance to compete globally with other Climathon locations in Paris. And they also receive a full-time membership to the Impact Hub and mentorship from our team to help move their idea along.
Okay, and so the focus this year is
how do we reduce the impact of tourism in Hawaii? We have about 20 different teams signed up so far, and we're still recruiting more. The more, the merrier. And we also have spaces for the public to get engaged if they don't have an idea that they want to form a team around. So we'll be having workshops, one by the Sierra Club looking at social justice and climate change, and another one by Project Drawdown. So it's a way for anybody to come and learn a little bit more. We had kind of a seed event where we had presentations by a bunch of local groups working on the climate and kind of initial brainstorms. So one idea that popped up was can we put a $1 tax, and I don't know if that's exactly the right word, but a fee for every visitor that comes to the island, and that could go into a pot of money that's used to pursue climate mitigation or to develop better waste management so we're not having to burn all of our trash, that sort of thing. Another idea that popped up is, you know, thinking about how much emissions come from shipping things like boogie boards and snorkels and these sorts of things that visitors tend to use for a few days and then throw away. And is there a way we can kind of start repurposing those? So we're reducing shipment, we're reducing the energy and greenhouse gas footprint of making things we use briefly and throw away. None of us really know how that would pan out or how it would work, and we're hoping that the right minds can come together and sort of build out the idea and pitch it.
Right, because you've got other things that they use, like beach mats.
Right, exactly.
You know?
Beach towels, water shoes. Yeah.
So really kind of there's a whole gamut out there.
Absolutely. Another idea that popped up was around composting. So right now, the city and county of Honolulu doesn't offer municipal composting. And some hotels and restaurants are required to put their food waste, divert it from the landfill, and they send it to piggeries. But there's still a ton of food waste that's not being dealt with. So is there a way we could start to build that up so that tourism is less impactful on our climate, on the aina? I can't speak to the full breadth of ideas that have come out of all of the different hackathons. So there are a couple that have popped up around decreasing water use in arid spaces as a way to, you know, ensure resource stability and reduce the need of shipping water around, of creating desalination plants, that kind of thing. Yeah, so some of them have been really high-tech like that, and some of them have been lower-tech.
I just was zeroing in on reusable utensils.
Yeah, that's a topic I love speaking about. Through my work with Zero Waste Oahu, we think about that a lot. And right now, the Department of Health regulations make it tricky for people to bring their own utensils or containers into certain spaces. Utensils are a little easier. So we're working on that. How can we kind of modernize our health and safety code so that people are still healthy and safe and we can bring our own containers places? So we do three main things. We do community outreach and education. So we give a lot of talks, and I try and do it outside of the so-called environmental community. I think this imaginary boundary has been created between people who care about the environment and others. And I don't think that's the way most people exist. We all care about humanity and each other, and that's what caring about the environment is. So trying to get out and talk to different sorts of people. We also do a lot of policy work. So there's Bill 40 coming up in the Honolulu County Council, and that would phase out several different types of single-use plastics by 2020, 2021. We haven't settled on the dates yet. So we're shepherding that along. We're training people how to show up and speak about the bill and why they care about it. And then the third thing we do, aside from education and policy, is we do zero waste demonstration projects. An example is at the Impact Hub. They didn't yet have a system for collecting food waste. So we set up that system and we found a place to send the food waste to. So we're helping to like de-risk and pilot systems so that people can start, you know, building out zero waste.
No, I know there are little things that you see at the airports when you travel where you can refill your water jug. You know, just little things like that that you're starting to see more of in businesses.
As part of our systems design arm, we do waste audits. We've primarily been doing them at hotels and with the University of Hawaii. And that allows us to see what's being thrown away, what these institutions are paying to throw away, what the social and environmental impact of that might be. And then we kind of help them make targeted solutions to reduce that part of the waste stream.
Okay, and then what are you doing in the schools? Anything?
Yeah, so one hat I wear is as the director and co-founder of Zero Waste Oahu, and I also work full-time for the Office of Sustainability at UH. So I have a lot of interface there. We're working on installing more water bottle refill stations, so we hear that from the students, staff, and faculty a lot. You know, it's so difficult to fill up my reusable water bottle. So we're installing 40 over the next couple years. Which we'll have one in most of our buildings now on the bottom floor. So that's a big improvement. Maybe not enough, but an improvement.
Yeah, but I imagine, though, as you work with, you know, the college students, right? I mean, they now are of the mind that, yeah, I'm going to stay away from bottled water.
Yeah, which is great.
Yeah, so, you know, they're trained already.
Yes.
You know, I think the idea is to get to people young and educate them so they develop these green habits.
Yeah, I almost think that's we're doing a great job of youth education. It's almost like we need to work on adult education and help some of our decision makers change.
So now with this climathon, are there any age restrictions on who can join and how that all works?
No, everybody is welcome. We want, you know, youth involved, professionals involved, amateurs involved. If you have an idea, this is the time and space to bring it to the table. No idea is too big or too small.
Okay, and you might get a trip to Paris.
And you might get a trip to Paris and a chance to dramatically change the climate footprint of Honolulu.
You've been hearing from Nicole Chatterson, founder of Zero Waste Oahu. Her group has partnered with Impact Hub Honolulu to launch the first Climathon Honolulu that will take place October 26th and 27th. At the Impact Hub in Kaka'ako. You can find links on how to sign up later today on our website. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet, and also some things we might be able to spot in our dark skies. As usual, we're grateful to have the expertise of astronomer Christopher Phillips at our disposal, and we're welcoming him back now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave, good to be back. So this week's stargazers, the bright planets of Jupiter and Saturn, can be found in the south after sunset. The planet Venus can also be seen low in the west just after the sun sets. The moon is passing through its last quarter phase this week, and by week's end, we will have a return to dark skies perfect for stargazing.
You mentioned Jupiter. I hear we have news about one of Jupiter's moons.
Indeed. Now, the universe is full of radiation, and one of the most energetic forms of radiation are the cosmic rays. These hard-hitting rays travel close to the speed of light, and they can originate from pretty much anywhere, including distant galaxies and even the sun. Cosmic rays, gamma rays, and ultraviolet rays can be very bad for life. And that's got NASA's scientists at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory very concerned indeed, because they're studying Jupiter's moon Europa, and they're worried that cosmic rays may destroy evidence of life on that frozen moon.
So are there not fields that sort of protect Europa the way that Earth has, that sort of thing?
Well, at first glance, it would appear that Europa has no protection because it doesn't really have an atmosphere or a strong magnetic field like the Earth. But it does have Jupiter. And it just so happens that Jupiter may be helping Europa survive the cosmic bombardment by reducing the amount of radiation it receives.
And that sounds like great news, but if we're going to explore Europa, we're still going to have to dig down to find evidence, right?
Absolutely. And that's no small task. The European ice sheet is estimated to be around a mile thick on average. That's a lot of ice. However, it may be possible to recover pristine samples from just a few yards down, which is just out of reach of those pesky cosmic rays.
Yeah, I don't see a mile-deep drill operation going on Europa any year soon. That's a good one. It's Christopher Phillips. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer, which we keep at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to create, maintain, and preserve open spaces for the Maui community. More at haleakalaranch.com.
Earlier in the program, we asked you to name one of the largest pagodas in the world. It's located in the Kyoto Gardens of Honolulu Memorial Park and stands 116 feet tall from the foundation to the tip of the spire. Architect Robert Katsuyoshi modeled it after the Minami Hokage Temple in Nara, Japan. The scale was 1.5 times larger, using concrete construction instead of traditional wood to allow it to be used as a columbarium along with the neighboring Kinkakuji Temple. The Sanju Pagoda was erected in 1966 and over the last few decades has been neglected and is in desperate need of structural repair. And that was the answer we were looking for. We had no winners today. That's the quiz for today. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Aloha Stadium played host this weekend to the Air Force Academy Falcons, who squared off against University of Hawaii's own Rainbow Warrior football program. Notable among the team's coaching staff was Lieutenant Colonel Kaipo McGuire, an Oahu native and St. Louis grad, now the Deputy Department Head for Physical Education at Air Force Academy. He sat down with the conversation's Harrison Patino to reflect on his career as a professional football player and Air Force veteran.
So how did your upbringing in Hawaii inform your perspective as an athlete and as an officer? How did it kind of change and shape your values in those two things?
Well, I think it's kind of hard to step out of yourself. But when I really look at it, I think it's a cultural thing. Hawaii is so unique where you have a blending of, you know, Polynesian culture, a lot of Asian culture, and it kind of shapes who you are. A lot of work ethic, a lot of respecting your elders, those types of things. If you stick to the sports realm, you always see kids from Hawaii. They always feel like they're representing the whole state of Hawaii when they move on to college, or if they're fortunate enough go on to the professional level. They feel like they're representing the whole people. And kids take it serious. I took it very serious. So every time I stepped on that field, I felt like I was representing the state, my family, my culture. So kind of growing up that way, it instilled in me work ethic. And when you feel like you're representing people, you kind of take it just a little more serious.
Did you feel that pressure at all during your professional career? Was it kind of a constant thing?
Absolutely. And when I discuss this topic, when I talk about culture and whatnot in my job as a sports psychologist, I always give a good example. When I got released after my third year in Indianapolis when I was playing for the Colts, I felt shame coming home because I felt so much pressure, if you will. It was self-induced because my family and friends and, of course, the people was proud of me, but I felt that I kind of let down the people of Hawaii. I'm over it now, though.
I'm hoping now that's not the case anymore.
Yeah. I'm over it.
So you were the athlete once. And now it seems like you're more in charge of training other athletes, or at the very least training the fitness and the testing and the conditioning of cadets.
Sure.
So how do you use your experience and apply it to kind of a new demographic? They're not exactly first years or red shirts, they're cadets. It's a little different.
Yes. So my job, I basically wear two hats. Half of the day, if you will, just to make it simple, I'm the deputy department head for physical education, which is at the Air Force Academy. Every cadet there has to take physical education classes. They have to meet fitness requirements. And so that population is very different than the Division I athletes that we have. So I take a different approach with that. The second half of the day, we have 29 varsity sports that I work with them, mental performance. So in one day, I could have an Olympic-level athlete in my office, and 2 hours later have those that can barely pass a fitness test. So taking that perspective, then definitely relying on experiences as well as the formal education helps.
So I promised I wouldn't call you doctor, but
okay.
You do have a PhD in social psychology of sport. So how does that really acute mental understanding of athletics and conditioning really come into play during your job?
Well, every day, whether it be formal education, when I'm sitting down counseling athletes, or team sessions that I run. What I'm trying to do is dumb down the concept, if you will. And this is just a personal opinion. There's a lot of folks that can say a lot of buzzwords and official definitions of what means what. But I think it takes a lot of work, if you will, to actually dumb it down where people can understand it in layman terms. So I try to take a concept, package it up very simply, and present it to the athletes. And hopefully they get one bit of information that can help them become better.
We're seeing in this day and age that we have sort of an increased social awareness with not just mental health, but brain injuries and serious lingering head injuries. Now, because you have this background, not just in education, but as a former athlete, how do you apply that towards your training with cadets?
So it's hard. Actually, I'm the old guy now. So, you know, back when I was playing, that wasn't helmet to helmet. It was just a good hit. Well, with this old age comes maturity and knowledge. The more you study, the more you realize you really don't know anything. But I think it's very serious. The NFL sends out to try to collect data. So as a former NFL player, I just took a survey and they asked me, when you were playing, did you even think about or were you concerned about, you know, CTE or head injuries or anything like that? Absolutely not. Well, now I am every single day. If I misplace my key somewhere, I'm like, oh my God, it's happening. So yes, I think we're trending in the right direction, absolutely. But just like everything else, the society, if you will, overcorrects. So like what is considered a concussion right now versus what was considered a concussion back then. I am happy that we're erring on the side of caution, but I think it's going to correct itself just a little more.
Are you finding that there's a tension between the older schools of thought of that's just a clean hit, that's how the game's played, and those newer schools of thought of, you know, coming at it with the data and understanding how this can really affect someone's brain and mind?
I do, but I think as a culture we're getting a lot better. At the end of the day, number one thing is safety, right? And if you take the perspective, hey, if that was my son or my daughter out there, what would you do? I think people would have they understand it a little better. I catch myself. I mean, I talk to my brother all the time where you see running backs, they run out of bounds. Well, when I was playing, you just duck your head or lower your shoulder and go get that extra 2 yards. The athletes nowadays, they're bigger, stronger, more capable. They're 10 times better than we were 5, 10, 20 years ago. But they're taught that. They are taught to run out of bounds. They're taught to avoid the big hit. So it's not a sign of weakness, if you will. It's just what the game is evolving so you can protect yourself.
So you're talking not just as an athlete, but as an officer in the Air Force. Mm-hmm. And your last assignment was as the Southern Information Operations Chief.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell a little bit about that?
I'm going to have to kill you. I'm just playing. Well, basically, my AOR area of responsibility was Central and South America. So think everything south of Mexico. Basically, information operations, if you will, there's a bunch of disciplines, but if you boil it down to what is simple, most people can relate to PSYOP, so psychological operations, basically winning hearts and minds of people. So like when you look at any wars, and you may say, well, we're not at war with Central South America. Well, there's a lot of drug wars and whatnot. A lot of our allies are in those countries. But when you win the people over, you win the war. That's the bottom line. So I try to use my psychology background to win hearts and minds of people.
So since you've left your professional career, you've had a pretty extensive career in the Air Force. What drove you to the Air Force right after your professional career?
Well, I always was interested in the Air Force and actually was thinking about getting commissioned while I was in college. Didn't do ROTC. So I figured, well, why am I going to take extra credits when I don't need to take classes? Just being fully transparent here. But thought about doing officer training school. Then actually went in and talked to a recruiter. And when I walked in, the recruiter said, what are you doing here? Aren't you going to play football? And I said, well, I don't know. I'm not sure. And they said, well, the Air Force isn't going anywhere. You got to go try this. So it was actually a recruiter through the Air Force that kind of pushed me to keep on chasing my dream. After those years playing professional, then I said, okay, this is it. You know, I was done playing football. Then I went back and got commissioned to the Air Force. So something I always wanted to do, something I was attracted to, and I felt just a desire to go serve my country.
How did you make that natural transition from doing some pretty intense operation in mm-hmm. Central and South America to more physical education?
Well, so I was assigned to the Air Force Academy 2006 to 2010 as a captain, and I had a phenomenal opportunity. They flat out asked me, hey, do you want to go get your doctorate degree? So I said, absolutely. So they sent me to school. I was still active duty, but 3 years I just went to school full time with the plan of me coming back and doing exactly what I'm doing now. So it just took a while, but I'm back now and actually using my doctorate degree. I don't use sports psychology in my quote-unquote normal Air Force job. Psychology, I use some of the concepts, but obviously not sports psychology.
I've known a lot of coaches in my day, and they all have to use psychology a little bit.
So they do.
I'm sure it applies somewhat.
Sure.
So what are some of the biggest differences now about athlete mental health and physical conditioning that you have to take into account when you're teaching these guys versus what was taught to you?
Stigma. So before, it was a sign of weakness to go get help, particularly mental health. But now it is changing for the better where you can admit that you have a problem and you go get help is actually a sign of strength. And a lot of the resources, i.e. money and manning, are being dedicated toward helping these athletes, which is a good thing. Like, I'm part of the mental health, but I am not clinical psychology, but I am one who usually is the first to see the red flags and refer when, at least in my organization.
By the time this airs, Air Force is going to have played UH. Do you have any split allegiance for that game?
So this is how, no. I know who writes my check, I'm just playing. Well, I work in the athletic department, so of course I work with these athletes on a daily basis. Of course I cheer for them. I want Air Force to win. I'm going to cheer for Air Force. However, it's like fantasy football. I want all the local kids to do well, but I want my team to win.
That was Lieutenant Colonel Kaipo McGuire, the Deputy Department Head for Physical Education at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, Colorado. The Oahu native and St. Louis grad was recently in town to accompany the Academy's football team, which faced off against UH's Rainbow Warriors this past weekend. Air Force ended up winning that game 56-26. We have to go, but tomorrow we talk about tension over the new windmills at Kahuku and the deliberate downing of a power line to try and block the project. Kapu Aloha, let's talk about it. We'd like to hear from you. Call our talkback line, leave your comments, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation, HPR, or tweet us at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.